Today is Michael Whitfield versus Nevada State Personnel Commission et al., case number 79718. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. I would indicate that the video's feed has, it just came back on. Thank you very much.
Can you hear us all right, Mr. Pick?
I can, Your Honor. The video feed was off for a second, but it's back on, so thank you very much.
And are you able to see the justices in Las Vegas?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Khan, can you see the six justices in Carson and in Las Vegas?
Yes, Your Honor. I can hear you also very well.
Okay, great. And then Justice Stiglitz is participating by video, but her feed isn't operating. She can hear us, I believe. Justice Stiglitz, can you hear us all right?
That's correct, Chief.
Okay. And so she'll be participating in this argument as well. All right. Mr. Khan, let's have you begin then.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Gil Khan, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant petitioner in this matter, Mr. Michael Whitfield. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, sir.
Your Honors, there can be no question that every entity and individual that Mr. Whitfield served his pro se petition for judicial review knew precisely what administrative decision was challenging and who was party to that proceeding. Indeed, Mr. Whitfield expressly stated that he sought to reverse the judgment of the Nevada State Personnel Commission, upholding his termination from the Nevada Department of Corrections. For good measure, he even included the administrative case number in the caption and the date of the decision. Yet the district court here held that he failed to name anyone in his petition. Your Honors, I plan to spend the bulk of my time today addressing why that decision is wholly at odds with both this court's recent decision in Prevost versus Department Administration and the principle that pro se pleadings must be liberally construed, and why the Personnel Commission was the only required agency respondent. I'll also briefly touch on Mr. Whitfield's alternate argument regarding Washoe County versus Otto, Your Honors. But to the first point, the parties here agree that NDOC was the only necessary party respondent other than Mr. Whitfield himself. And we also seem to agree that the Personnel Commission was a necessary agency respondent. The primary argument on appeal, Your Honors, really breaks into two issues. Were these entities sufficiently named? They were. And were there any other necessary agency respondents? There aren't. But to the first point, this court's decision in Prevost definitively demonstrates that Mr. Whitfield sufficiently named NDOC and the Personnel Commission. In that case, Your Honors, the petitioner did not name the purportedly missing employer, CCMSI, anywhere in his petition. Rather, it appeared in the attached administrative decision. Now, I reviewed the appendix of that case, Your Honors, and this court should and can take judicial notice of it. And the employer didn't even appear in the caption. It was simply referenced in the introductory paragraph. And clearly that decision could not have named the employer as a respondent to the petition for judicial review because that petition was not yet filed. So the mere mention of the employer in the attached decision was sufficient to name that entity as a respondent. Here, Mr. Whitfield's petition was even far more clear. He expressly named both entities in the body of the petition itself, not in an attached document, and provided the exact context in which those entities were being named and challenged. This is more than sufficient under Prevost. And that is especially true, Your Honors, given the fact that unlike Prevost, Mr. Whitfield was acting here pro se at the time. And this court and many others, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have consistently held that pro se pleadings must be liberally construed. Even the district court here, in its motion to dismiss order, stated, and I quote here, that Mr. Whitfield sought, quote, to challenge the final judgment of the Nevada's State Personnel Commission, the record at 62. That statement is wholly at odds with the district court's ultimate conclusion. They failed to name anyone, a ruling that cannot stand under Prevost. So that leads to the point, Your Honor, of who should be named in this particular petition. Now, respondents argue that the Department Administration, the Personnel Commission, and its hearing officer should have been named. But as an initial point to that, Your Honors, the respondents have not, and indeed cannot, point to any provision of the APA, specifically Section 130, that requires multiple agencies to be named. The reason for that is simple, Your Honors. Section 130 discusses the agency in strictly singular language, consistently over and over throughout its subsection. In contrast, it refers to the party respondents in the plural, recognizing the simple reality that there can be multiple parties to proceeding, sometimes hundreds, while only one agency only renders the ultimate decision that is being challenged, the contested case at Section 130, words is. So, which agency here rendered the final decision? It's not the Department of Administration, which simply is an overarching entity that provides a vast array of government services through a plethora of divisions that range from fleet services to public works to the Nevada State Library. The Department of Administration doesn't appoint the commission. It doesn't appoint the hearing officer. And most importantly, it doesn't regulate the employment hearings at issue. So that leaves, of course, the commission and its hearing officer. And that, Your Honor, is where this court's analysis in Cooper Roofing, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis in Eagles Shipbuildings, comes into play. Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis is particularly relevant here, because there it held in Eagles that because the Secretary of Labor appointed the members of the Benefits Review Board and regulated their hearings, that the decision of the Review Board was the decision of the Department of Labor, and therefore the Department of Labor was the correct agency respondent.
And that is Mr. Kahn? Sorry, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Hopefully you can find the right box on your screen. So I just want to go back a little bit. So you know from our case law that administrative review cases are narrowly construed according to what the statutes allow. If there are certain specific requirements, they have to be met for the courts to have jurisdiction over that appeal. So in reading NRS 233B.132A, it specifically requires that the petition for judicial review must name as respondents the agency and all parties of record to the administrative proceeding. I've listened to your argument. I understand, I think, your argument, but he didn't name anybody as respondents. And how do we construe what he submitted as satisfying that requirement?
Your Honor, that's precisely where, again, Prevost comes into play. The question there was, did the petitioner, Mr. Prevost, sufficiently name CCMSI as a respondent? And what does it mean to be named as a respondent? Well, clearly, in this court's decision, it's not required to include the word respondent because CCMI was never named as a respondent in that attached administrative decision. It was simply referenced in the introductory paragraph. As I mentioned, that administrative decision could not have even referred or given the implication that CCMSI was a respondent to the petition for judicial review because, Your Honor, that petition was not yet filed. So as Justice Stiglitz mentioned in her dissent, the mere mention of the word CCMSI in an attached document was, in that case, sufficient to name it as a respondent. We have a much more clear situation here, Your Honor.
Well, at least the attached pleading would show who the parties to the prior proceeding were, right?
not even necessarily on her. The decision, and I've reviewed it carefully, was relatively vague. It mentioned that it was one of the employers. That decision doesn't even expressly state that that employer was a party respondent to the administrative decision. But here, the Mr. Whitfield's petition also expressly states exactly the context in which these parties are being named. He expressly, I'm looking at the petition now at Appendix 1, he's saying he's seeking to reverse the decision of the Nevada State Personnel Commission, indicating that it is the agency that rendered the administrative decision, and upheld the decision of Nevada Department of Corrections to find him ineligible for reinstatement or rehire. And because the context of this was the employment hearing, then the employer, NDOC, was the party respondent. So under Prevost, this more than sufficiently names these entities as respondents, especially, Your Honor, because, as I mentioned, unlike Prevost, Mr. Whitfield here was acting pro se at the time. And although the APA does have a strict compliance requirement, that doesn't necessarily abrogate the principle that pro se pleadings must be liberally construed. So under any standard, Your Honor, I submit that Mr. Whitfield more than adequately named the necessary parties.
So your position is that by including uttering Nevada Department of Corrections and Nevada State Personnel Commission in the petition for judicial review, that sufficiently meets the statutory requirements?
I submit that is what Prevost holds, but I would also add to that that I would say that he more than uttered the words. He provided the precise context in which those parties, what role they played in the administrative proceeding, that the Personnel Commission was rendering the judgment. So he didn't use the word agency respondent. This court has never required that, but that it rendered the judgment, indicating that it provided the final determination, upholding the decision of NDOC being the only other party respondent. Unless this court has any other questions at that point, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Pick, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you very much. It pleases the court, Senior Deputy Attorney General Kevin Pick on behalf of the Nevada Department of Corrections. Good morning, Your Honors. In briefing, Mr. Whitfield has raised three primary arguments, each of which I'll be discussing here. The first primary argument is as to whether Mr. Whitfield's original petition strictly complied with the APA's naming requirements. And the place I'd like to begin, Your Honors, is the statute. It's a relevant statute. It's NRS 233B130, Section 2A, which, as Your Honor pointed out, petitions for judicial review must name as respondents the agency and all parties of record. Agency is defined under NRS Chapter 233B. Party is defined under NRS Chapter 233B. And as this court explained in Otto, because courts have no inherent appellate jurisdiction over administrative agencies, the APA's language is controlling here, and strict compliance is a precondition to jurisdiction. So strict compliance with the APA's naming requirements is required in order to invoke the jurisdiction of the district court. And as mentioned in the Prevost decision and as referenced in the Otter decision, the naming requirements are satisfied by naming the respondents in the caption, the body of the petition, or in an attachment incorporated by reference. Here, it's undisputed that there was no attachment to the PJR. It's undisputed there were no respondents named in the caption. So that only leaves the body through which the petitioner possibly could have complied with these mandatory and jurisdictional rules. The petitioner claims that he did name the Personnel Commission and NDOC as respondents in the body of the petition, but he clearly didn't comply with the APA's strict compliance requirement. In fact, nowhere is there any reference to a respondent whatsoever in the entire petition, except where the petitioner mistakenly refers to himself as the respondent.
And so, excuse me, could I interrupt you there? This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas, and I'll give you a moment to orient on your screen. So is it your position, looking at the petition for judicial review, that this would have been good if on line 19 he had inserted the word respondent in front of Nevada State Personnel Commission, And if on line 21, he'd done the same for Nevada Department of Corrections. Leave to one side for a moment your separate argument about additional parties that should have been named. Just stay with me and assume, for the sake of this question, that the two appropriate respondents were the ones named in the petition.
So, well, Your Honor, I think it would have... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's fine. I think you have my point.
Your Honor, it's really not a matter of, you know, uttering the magic words respondent. It's a matter of complying, if I can be frank, with the statute. And the statute requires a petitioner to name parties as respondents. And that clearly wasn't done here in this case, and not in a matter that comports with strict compliance.
Well,
and
but so, I'm trying to elicit from you an answer to a simple question. Would you say this petition passed muster for purposes of the argument you're making if the word respondent had been inserted in lines 19 and 21 of page 1 of the petition?
I think it would have been sufficient, Your Honor, if the petitioner said something to the effects of, I, petitioner, hereby name as respondents the following agencies and parties. That would have been sufficient, and that's the standard that's used with respect to this provision. So not just not inserting the rule, the name respondent, it's putting them in context in this case, because as to NDOC...
Well, let me pause you right there. Would you agree with me that in Prevost, Justice Perigary... opinion in footnote 3 rejects the proposition that the rules of civil procedure do not apply once the case gets to district court. They hold that the rules do apply under Rule 81 to the extent they're not inconsistent with the statutory requirements, right?
Well, I do believe that Rule 81 would indicate that the rules of civil procedure do apply. To the extent not consistent, that's certainly what NRCP 81 says. As to the discussion about the applicability of Prevost, Your Honor, Prevost absolutely does not apply to this case, and Prevost actually...
But let me pause you there before you go off on Prevost. I was focused on footnote 3 there. Rule 8 of the Rules of Civil Procedure addresses what pleadings need to have, and they caution Rule 8D1 says... each allegation must be simple, concise, and direct, and here I would put emphases, no technical form is required. So I have trouble calling someone out. I mean, in Otto, the complaint gave zero names. It had no names. It said this certain unidentified parties, and it did it in parentheticals, almost sarcastic to the proceeding itself. Here you do have the people named, and I struggle with saying this is defective for that reason. And then I would also ask for your comment on subparagraph E of the Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 8E. Pleadings must be construed so as to do justice. To me, you have the name. They didn't denominate it respondent, but you have the names of the two things. You have the commission and NDOT, and he says, I'd like that order that the commission entered reversed, and I'd like my job back with NDOT. What more do you need for this to work? I get the caption was deficient, but courts generally will allow people to amend pleadings to fix a caption if the pleading was timely filed and served, and the parties who were respondent weren't prejudiced.
Well, Your Honor, I would just say that to the extent that Rule 8 allows substantial compliance as opposed to strict compliance, then it is completely adverse to the rule, the APA here, and under Rule 81, that would not apply.
You think the designation of respondent you think is critical to the statute 233B, 130, whatever?
Well, I think you actually have to name them as respondents, Your Honor, and it's not just using magic words. It's defining their role in this case, and that simply wasn't done.
What about the idea that strict compliance applies to time deadlines and so forth, but form and manner is subject to substantial compliance? Is that, in your estimation, ruled out by Otto?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I mean, Otto does indicate very clearly, based on the mandatory word must, as used by the Nevada legislature, that those terms are indeed mandatory and strict compliance is required in order to invoke jurisdiction. And as this court pointed out in the Heat and Frost Insulators case, the only one that is subject to essentially excuse for based on good cause is the service requirement. And that's because under NRS 233B-130 Section 5, there's a special carve-out for untimely service where a district court could allow that to happen. And so what I think is important to recognize is that there's an exception under the statute for untimely service. There are no exceptions that the Nevada legislature has made for not complying with the naming and filing requirements. And as this court has time and time again emphasized, those are mandatory and jurisdictional. And I think, Your Honor, that it's not just a matter of it being a technical pleading requirement. It's a mandatory requirement. And it really goes to a fundamental principle based on separation of powers, is that the judicial branch has no inherent authority.
Before you go there, sir, I don't want to monopolize your time, but Prevost, they didn't name them as respondents in the caption, and they didn't name them as respondents in the body. But their names were, and their defensive posture were, clear from the attachment. Why doesn't that refute your argument that the failure to name them, call them respondents in this document, is fatal?
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes very closely to the basis for the Prevost decision was the attachment. The attachment is the important part in Prevost because the attachment of that document allowed the petitioner in there to invoke Rule 10C, and that in the all-purpose language. NRCP 10C allows attached documents to be used for, quote, all purposes. And it was through that all-purposes language via the attachment that allowed the respondents to be named through the attached document. There was no attachment here, so Rule 10C cannot be invoked by this petitioner, and I've not seen an argument that they have tried to invoke Rule 10C. And so the basis for the Prevost decision, frankly, does demonstrate how deficient this pleading was in complying with the strict requirements here.
Mr. Pick, this is Justice Hardesty in Carson. Would the analysis that Justice Pickering has been suggesting in her questions subvert Otto and the statute it interpreted?
Absolutely think it would, Your Honor, because I think it would shift more to a substantial compliance standard, which is adverse to both Otto, which practitioners and the courts in multiple cases have found as binding and used as guiding authority for the last 9 years. And on top of that, it really does go against the basic principle on whether district courts have inherent appellate jurisdiction over administrative agencies within the executive branch. As the court pointed out in Otto, that inherent appellate authority does not exist unless there's specific provisions that have been set forth by the legislature. Here there are, but those have to be mandatory and strictly complied with. Your Honor, I would like to go back with my remaining time here and just briefly talk about NDOC and how they're mentioned in this petition. The only mention of NDOC in the entire petition is as to the petitioner's former position, quote, as the Nevada Department of Corrections. There's no indication at all that NDOC was even a party to the underlying administrative proceeding here. And the petitioner simply mentions that he used to work at NDOC. That clearly is not strict compliance because a reader must infer why NDOC is being mentioned in the first place here. Respondents should not be put in a position where they're forced to guess as to their potential future involvement in a case. And if a reader is forced to speculate as to why a party or agency is even being mentioned, then it's not strict compliance. As to the Personnel Commission, it's mentioned twice in the decision by the petition for judicial review, but it's mentioned with regard to the decision of the Personnel Commission, not as a respondent that has a role in this case moving forward. NRS 233B-132A does not state identify the case or order on appeal. It says name the parties as respondents. And so, again, if the standard is strict compliance, then this would require the court and the parties and the agencies to all take a leap of inference that what their role could possibly be in this case moving forward. And, again, that's not strict compliance. With my remaining time, Your Honors, I would like to move on to the second argument, and that's the based on principles of equity, justice, and fairness, whether the court should create an exception to the APA's mandatory and jurisdictional rules for pro se parties. Your Honor, I'd just like to point out the statute in this case itself makes no exception for pro se parties. It's mandatory for all parties. And so to carve out an exception for certain individuals who are not represented would be completely contrary to what the mandatory nature of these the statute is and requires. Furthermore, Your Honor, as we've pointed out, courts in other jurisdictions have routinely held that pro se parties even must nonetheless meet basic jurisdictional requirements. And the petitioners in this case have not cited any authority where a court has waived a basic subject matter jurisdiction requirement to the benefit of pro se parties. As to the idea, Your Honors, that the APA's naming requirements were so confusing that this that the court should create an exception to Otto and the APA's mandatory rules, this, frankly, is a false argument that the petitioner has set forth because he clearly was not confused about which parties to name. He didn't name any parties or agencies as respondents in the petition. And he wasn't confused as to which respondents to name because he, in fact, served the Department of Administration, NDOC, and the Hearings Division. He just didn't name them as was required. Your Honor, with the last argument here is whether the APA does not expressly prohibit the amendment of a defective petition after the 30-day deadline. They argue that it does not expressly prohibit it, so they asked the court to essentially throw out Otto and allow the untimely amendment of a petition for judicial review of a defective petition. However, the APA certainly does prohibit that sort of thing. The APA's naming requirement is mandatory. The APA's 30-day filing requirement is mandatory. And Otto instructs that strict compliance is a precondition to jurisdiction. And as we've indicated earlier, Your Honor, the legislative intent on this is clear that it's mandatory and jurisdictional because if the legislature wanted to carve out an exception to this mandatory and jurisdictional requirement, the naming requirement, it could have done so as it did with the service requirement. As to the liberal amendment standard under NRCP 15, well, Your Honor, not even NRCP 15 allows a district court to liberally construe or allow an amendment of a pleading if the district court never obtained jurisdiction in the first place. So with that, Your Honors, the district court in this case correctly followed binding precedent in Washoe County v. Otto, which is not a trap for the unwary, and Ms. Otto certainly was not to blame for the deficiencies in this case. We'd ask the court to affirm the district court order. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fick. Mr. Kahn, you have 4 minutes.
Are you muted?
I believe you're muted, Mr. Kahn. No worries.
I promised myself I wouldn't forget that. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Easy to do. I do it all the time. Go ahead, sir.
I promised myself I wouldn't do that, but inevitably it happened. But thank you, Your Honors. Respectfully, respondents just said several contradictory things in regards to the primary issue. Did Mr. Whitfield's petition adequately name NDOC and the Personnel Commission? Basically, he said the petition can't lead to guess or speculation as to who the parties are to the petition. And clearly the record demonstrates here that simply isn't the case. Mr. Pick himself appeared on behalf of NDOC once the Attorney General's office, as required by the statute, was served with Mr. Whitfield's petition for judicial review. So clearly, the Attorney General's office was aware that NDOC, as a party, was being challenged, including as well the Personnel Commission. There's just no room, based on the fact that the petition itself names the context of the parties, to Justice Pickering's point, and the administrative case number was mentioned, that there was any confusion among the Attorney General's office or the district court regarding precisely what this petition for judicial review was challenging. And yes, there is no dispute that Otto requires strict compliance. But Your Honor, this court has also said in different contexts that strict compliance is not absurd compliance. For example, Einhorn versus DAC home loans. And respondents have also pointed, have still not articulated, what is the standard here? On one hand, they said, well, you don't have to utter some magic words. That was the precise description. But at the same time, they are inevitably requiring that a petitioner include the word respondent in front of the name of that entity in order to name the respondent. And again, to Justice Pickering's point, that has never been what this court has required. In fact, they look back at the Prevost decision, at the appendix, and the attached administrative decision simply says the claimant, Robert Prevost, was represented by his counsel, name, the employer, State of Nevada Department of Corrections Administrator, CCMI, hereafter referred to as employer, was represented by Daniel Schwartz. It goes on to name the law firm. At no point was it named as a respondent or could have it been named a respondent, because again, this decision predated Mr. Prevost's petition for judicial review. With my last little bit of time remaining, Your Honors, I want to briefly touch on Washoe County versus Otto and demonstrate why that decision respectfully has led to an unworkable standard. Because on one hand, the statute demands strict compliance. But on the other hand, the APA does not specifically and directly inform petitioners, many of them appearing pro se, on who, what entities have to be named as respondents. We see this in this case in the sense that the respondents suggest that the Department of Administration should be named, but point to no provision of the APA of Section 13 that would require that result. Similarly, as Cooper Roofing demonstrates, petitioners are responsible for overlaying Supreme Court precedent to determine whether an entity is sufficiently independent of an overarching entity to be required to be named.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to ask a point about Otto, because I don't think it's necessary at all to even revisit Otto in its actual holding here. Because Otto emphasizes, and I'm reading, because certain taxpayers unidentified does not name anyone, we conclude that Washoe County failed to comply with the mandatory requirement to name the individual taxpayer. So Otto, there were zero names. They, in fact, went and said, certain taxpayers, open paren, unidentified, close paren, that was the extent of the naming. In Otto, this case I submit has the names, and their posture is pretty well described, actually. I wish more pleadings were this brief. So this is not, I don't think you have to get there. Would you agree with that?
I see I'm out of time. May I briefly respond to that, Chief Justice?
Yes, of course. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. Your Honor, I of course completely agree with you. Otto is, to be perfectly clear, is an argument in the alternative. In the case that this court determines that Mr. Whitfield should have named an additional agency or a different agency as the agency respondent, then we submit that he should have had the opportunity after the 30 days to go back and amend that petition because it was timely filed in the first place. But you're completely correct that this court need not ever reach that argument because it should find in the first instance that he adequately named NDOC and the Personnel Commission and that they were the only required party and agency respondent. With that, Your Honor, I just respectfully request that this court reverse the judgment of the district court and remand for further proceedings.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gaughan. Thank you, Mr. Crick, for your briefing and for your excellent oral argument this morning. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until 11 a.m. To discuss the Morency case.